I suspect that Aristotle, to the end, thought of him as that idle and headstrong boy who never could understand anything of philosophy. On the whole, the contacts of these two great men seem to have been as unfruitful as if they had lived in different worlds. From 335 BC to 323 BC, in which latter year Alexander died, Aristotle lived at Athens. It was during these 12 years that he founded his school and wrote most of his books. At the death of Alexander, the Athenians rebelled and turned on his friends, including Aristotle, who was indicted for impiety, but unlike Socrates, fled to avoid punishment. In the next year, 322, he died. Aristotle as a philosopher is in many ways very different from all his predecessors. He is the first to write like a professor. His treatises are systematic. His discussions are divided into heads. He is a professional teacher, not an inspired prophet. His work is critical, careful, pedestrian, without any trace of Bacchic enthusiasm. The Orphic elements in Plato are watered down in Aristotle and mixed with a strong dose of common sense. Where he is Platonic, one feels that his natural temperament has been overpowered by the teaching to which he has been subjected. He is not passionate or in any profound sense religious. The errors of his predecessors were the glorious errors of youth, attempting the impossible. His errors are those of age, which cannot free itself of habitual prejudices. He is best in detail and in criticism. He fails in large construction, for lack of fundamental clarity and titanic fire. It is difficult to decide at what point to begin an account of Aristotle's metaphysics, but perhaps the best place is his criticism of the theory of ideas and his own alternative doctrine of universals. He advances against the ideas a number of very good arguments, most of which are already to be found in Plato's Parmenides. The strongest argument is that of the third man. If a man is a man because he resembles the ideal man, there must be a still more ideal man to whom both ordinary men and the ideal man are similar. Again, Socrates is both a man and an animal, and the question arises whether the ideal man is an ideal animal. If he is, there must be as many ideal animals as there are species of animals. It is needless to pursue the matter. Aristotle makes it obvious that when a number of individuals share a predicate, this cannot be because of relations to something of the same kind as themselves, but more ideal. This much may be taken as proved, but Aristotle's own doctrine is far from clear. It was this lack of clarity that made possible the medieval controversy between nominalists and realists. Aristotle's metaphysics, roughly speaking, may be described as Plato diluted by common sense. He is difficult because Plato and common sense do not mix easily. When one tries to understand him, one thinks part of the time that he is expressing the ordinary views of a person innocent of philosophy, and the rest of the time that he is setting forth Platonism with a new vocabulary. It does not do to lay too much stress on any single passage, because there is liable to be a correction or modification of it in some later passage. On the whole, the easiest way to understand both his theory of universals and his theory of matter and form is to set forth first the common sense doctrine, which is half of his view, and then to consider the Platonic modifications to which he subjects it. Up to a certain point, the theory of universals is quite simple. In language, there are proper names and there are adjectives. The proper names apply to things or persons, each of which is the only thing or person to which the name in question applies. The sun, the moon, France, Napoleon are unique. There are not a number of instances of things to which these names apply. On the other hand, words like cat, dog, man apply to many different things. The problem of universals is concerned with the meanings of such words and also of adjectives such as white, hard, round, and so on. He says, "By the term universal, I mean that which is of such a nature as to be predicated of many subjects. By individual, that which is not thus predicated." What is signified by a proper name is a substance, while what is signified by an adjective or class name, such as human or man, is called a universal. A substance is a this, but a universal is a such. It indicates the sort of thing, not the actual particular thing. A universal is not a substance because it is not a this. Plato's heavenly bed would be of this to those who could perceive it. This is a matter as to which Aristotle disagrees with Plato. It seems impossible, Aristotle says, that any universal term should be the name of a substance, for the substance of each thing is that which is peculiar to it, which does not belong to anything else. But the universal is common, since that is called universal which is such as to belong to more than one thing. The gist of the matter so far is that a universal cannot exist by itself, but only in particular things. Superficially, Aristotle's doctrine is plain enough. Suppose I say, there is such a thing as the game of football. Most people would regard the remark as a truism. But if I were to infer that football could exist without football players, I should be rightly held to be talking nonsense. Similarly, it would be held there is such a thing as parenthood, but only because there are parents. There is such a thing as sweetness, but only because there are sweet things, and there is redness, but only because there are red things. And this dependence is thought not to be reciprocal. The men who play football would still exist even if they never played football. Things which are usually sweet may turn sour, and my face, which is usually red, may turn pale without ceasing to be my face. In this way, we are led to conclude that what is meant by an adjective is dependent for its being on what is meant by a proper name, but not vice versa. This, I think, is what Aristotle means. His doctrine on this point, as on many others, is a common-sense prejudice pedantically expressed. But it is not easy to give precision to the theory. Granted that football could not exist without football players, it could perfectly well exist without this or that football player. And granted that a person can exist without playing football, he nevertheless cannot exist without doing something. The quality redness cannot exist without some subject, but it can exist without this or that subject. Similarly, a subject cannot exist without some quality, but can exist without this or that quality. The supposed ground for the distinction between things and qualities thus seems to be illusory. The true ground of the distinction is, in fact, linguistic. It is derived from syntax. There are proper names, adjectives, and relation words. We may say, John is wise, James is foolish, John is taller than James. Here, John and James are proper names, wise and foolish are adjectives, and taller is a relation word. Metaphysicians, ever since Aristotle, have interpreted these syntactical differences metaphysically. John and James are substances. Wisdom and folly are universals. Relation words were ignored or misinterpreted. It may be that, given sufficient care, metaphysical differences can be found that have some relation to these syntactical differences, but if so, it will be only by means of a long process, involving, incidentally, the creation of an artificial philosophical language. And this language will contain no such names as John and James, and no such adjectives as wise and foolish. All the words of ordinary languages will have yielded to analysis and been replaced by words having a less complex significance. Until this labor has been performed, the question of particulars and universals cannot be adequately discussed. And when we reach the point at which we can at last discuss it, we shall find that the question we are discussing is quite different from what we supposed it to be at the outset. If, therefore, I have failed to make Aristotle's theory of universals clear, that is, I maintain, because it is not clear, but it is certainly an advance on the theory of ideas and is certainly concerned with a genuine and very important problem. There is another term which is important in Aristotle and in his scholastic followers, and that is the term essence. This is by no means synonymous with universal. Your essence is what you are by your very nature. It is, one may say, those of your properties which you cannot lose without ceasing to be yourself. Not only an individual thing, but a species has an essence. The definition of a species should consist in mentioning its essence. I shall return to the conception of essence in connection with Aristotle's logic. For the present, I will merely observe that it seems to be a muddle-headed action, incapable of precision. The next point in Aristotle's metaphysics is the distinction of form and matter. It must be understood that matter, in the sense in which it is opposed to form, is different from matter as opposed to mind. Here again, there is a common sense basis for Aristotle's theory, but here, more than in the case of universals, the Platonic modifications are very important. We may start with a marble statue. Here, marble is the matter, while the shape conferred by the sculptor is the form. Or to take Aristotle's examples, if a man makes a bronze sphere, bronze is the matter and sphericity is the form. While in the case of a calm sea, water is the matter and smoothness is the form. So far, all is simple. He goes on to say that it is in virtue of the form that the matter is some one definite thing, and this is the substance of the thing. What Aristotle means seems to be plain common sense. A thing must be bounded, and the boundary constitutes its form. Take, say, a volume of water. Any part of it can be marked off from the rest by being enclosed in a vessel, and then this part becomes a thing. But so long as the part is in no way marked out from the rest of the homogeneous mass, it is not a thing. A statue is a thing, and the marble of which it is composed is, in a sense, unchanged from what it was as part of a lump or as part of the contents of a quarry. We should not naturally say that it is the form that confers substantiality, but that is because the atomic hypothesis is ingrained in our imagination. Each atom, however, if it is a thing, is so in virtue of its being delimited from other atoms, and so having, in some sense, a form. We now come to a new statement, which at first sight seems difficult. The soul, we are told, is the form of the body. Here it is clear that form does not mean shape. I shall return later to the sense in which the soul is the form of the body. For the present, I will only observe that in Aristotle's system, the soul is what makes the body one thing, having unity of purpose and the characteristics that we associate with the word organism. The purpose of an eye is to see, but it cannot see when parted from its body. In fact, it is the soul that sees. It would seem, then, that form is what gives unity to a portion of matter, and that this unity is usually, if not always, teleological. But form turns out to be much more than this, and the more is very difficult. The form of a thing, we are told, is its essence and primary substance. Forms are substantial, although universals are not. When a man makes a brazen sphere, both the matter and the form already existed, and all that he does is to bring them together. The man does not make the form any more than he makes the brass. Not everything has matter. There are eternal things, and these have no matter, except those of them that are movable in space. Things increase in actuality by acquiring form. Matter without form is only a potentiality. The view that forms are substances, which exist independently of the matter in which they are exemplified, seems to expose Aristotle to his own arguments against Platonic ideas. A form is intended by him to be something quite different from a universal, but it has many of the same characteristics. Form is, we are told, more real than matter. This is reminiscent of the sole reality of the ideas. The change that Aristotle makes in Plato's Metaphysics is, it would seem, less than he represents it as being. This view is taken by Seller, who, on the question of matter and form, says, "The final explanation of Aristotle's want of clearness on this subject is, however, to be found in the fact that he had only half emancipated himself, as we shall see, from Plato's tendency to hypostasize ideas. The forms had for him, as the ideas had for Plato, a metaphysical existence of their own, as conditioning all individual things. And keenly as he followed the growth of ideas out of experience, it is nonetheless true that these ideas, especially at the point where they are farthest removed from experience and immediate perception, are metamorphosed in the end from a logical product of human thought into an immediate presentment of a supersensible world and the object, in that sense, of an intellectual intuition." I do not see how Aristotle could have found a reply to this criticism. The only answer that I can imagine would be one that maintained that no two things could ever have the same form. If a man makes two brass spheres, we should have to say, each has its own special sphericity, which is substantial and particular, an instance of the universal sphericity, but not identical with it. I do not think the language of the passages I quoted would readily support this interpretation. and it would be open to the objection that the particular sphericity would, on Aristotle's view, be unknowable, whereas it is of the essence of his metaphysics that as there comes to be more of form and less of matter, things become gradually more knowable. This is only consistent with the rest of his views if the form can be embodied in many particular things. If he were to say that there are as many forms that are instances of sphericity as there are spherical things, he would have to make very radical alterations in his philosophy. For instance, his view that a form is identical with its essence is incompatible with the above suggested escape. The doctrine of matter and form in Aristotle is connected with the distinction of potentiality and actuality. Bare matter is conceived as a potentiality of form. All change is what we should call evolution, in the sense that after the change the thing in question has more form than before. That which has more form is considered to be more actual. God is pure form and pure actuality. In him, therefore, there can be no change. It will be seen that this doctrine is optimistic and teleological. The universe and everything in it is developing towards something continually better than what went before. The concept of potentiality is convenient in some connections, provided it is so used that we can translate our statements into a form in which the concept is absent. A block of marble is a potential statue, means, from a block of marble, by suitable acts, a statue is produced. But when potentiality is used as a fundamental and irreducible concept, it always conceals confusion of thought. Aristotle's use of it is one of the bad points in his system. Aristotle's theology is interesting and closely connected with the rest of his metaphysics. Indeed, theology is one of his names for what we call metaphysics. The book which we know under that name was not so called by him. There are, he says, three kinds of substances: those that are sensible and perishable, those that are sensible but not perishable, and those that are neither sensible nor perishable. The first class includes plants and animals, the second includes the heavenly bodies, which Aristotle believed to undergo no change except motion, the third includes the rational soul in man and also God. The main argument for God is the first cause. There must be something which originates motion, and this something must itself be unmoved, and must be eternal substance and actuality. The object of desire and the object of thought, Aristotle says, cause movement in this way without themselves being in motion. So God produces motion by being loved, whereas every other cause of motion works by being itself in motion, like a billiard ball. God is pure thought, for thought is what is best. Life also belongs to God, for the actuality of thought is life, and God is that actuality. And God's self-dependent actuality is life most good and eternal. We say, therefore, that God is a living being, eternal, most good, so that life and duration, continuous and eternal, belong to God, for this is God. It is clear, then, from what has been said, that there is a substance which is eternal and unmovable and separate from sensible things. It has been shown that this substance cannot have any magnitude, but is without parts and indivisible. But it has also been shown that it is impassive and unalterable, for all the other changes are posterior to change of place. God does not have the attributes of a Christian providence, for it would derogate from his perfection to think about anything except what is perfect, that is, himself. It must be of itself that the divine thought thinks, since it is the most excellent of things, and its thinking is a thinking on thinking. We must infer that God does not know of the existence of our sublunary world. Aristotle, like Spinoza, holds that while men must love God, it is impossible that God should love men. God is not definable as the unmoved mover. On the contrary, astronomical considerations lead to the conclusion that there are either 47 or 55 unmoved movers. The relation of these to God is not made clear. Indeed, the natural interpretation would be that there are 47 or 55 gods. For after one of the above passages on God, Aristotle proceeds, "We must not ignore the question whether we are to suppose one such substance or more than one," and at once embarks upon the argument that leads to the 47 or 55 unmoved movers. The conception of an unmoved mover is a difficult one. To a modern mind, it would seem that the cause of a change must be a previous change, and that if the universe were ever wholly static, it would remain so eternally. To understand what Aristotle means, we must take account of what he says about causes. There are, according to him, four kinds of causes, which were called respectively material, formal, efficient, and final. Let us take again the man who is making a statue. The material cause of the statue is the marble. The formal cause is the essence of the statue to be produced. The efficient cause is the contact of the chisel with the marble, and the final cause is the end that the sculptor has in view. In modern terminology, the word cause would be confined to the efficient cause. The unmoved mover may be regarded as a final cause. It supplies a purpose for change, which is essentially an evolution towards likeness with God. I said that Aristotle was not by temperament deeply religious, but this is only partly true. One could perhaps interpret one aspect of his religion somewhat freely as follows. God exists eternally as pure thought, happiness, complete self-fulfillment, without any unrealized purposes. The sensible world, on the contrary, is imperfect, but it has life, desire, thought of an imperfect kind, and aspiration. All living things are in a greater or less degree aware of God, and are moved to action by admiration and love of God. Thus, God is the final cause of all activity. Change consists in giving form to matter, but where sensible things are concerned, a substratum of matter always remains. Only God consists of form without matter. The world is continually evolving towards a greater degree of form, and thus becoming progressively more like God. But the process cannot be completed because matter cannot be wholly eliminated. This is a religion of progress and evolution, for God's static perfection moves the world only through the love that finite beings feel for him. Plato was mathematical. Aristotle was biological. This accounts for the differences in their religions. This would, however, be a one-sided view of Aristotle's religion. He has also the Greek love of static perfection and preference for contemplation rather than action. His doctrine of the soul illustrates this aspect of his philosophy. Whether Aristotle taught immortality in any form or not was a vexed question among commentators. Averroes, who held that he did not, had followers in Christian countries, of whom the more extreme were called Epicureans, and whom Dante found in hell. In fact, Aristotle's doctrine is complex and easily lends itself to misunderstandings. In his book On the Soul, he regards the soul as bound up with the body and ridicules the Pythagorean doctrine of transmigration. The soul, it seems, perishes with the body. It indubitably follows that the soul is inseparable from its body. But he immediately adds, or at any rate certain parts of it are. Body and soul are related as matter and form. The soul must be a substance in the sense of the form of a material body having life potentially within it. But substance is actuality, and thus soul is the actuality of a body as above characterized. Soul is substance in the sense which corresponds to the definitive formula of a thing's essence. That means that it is the essential whatness of a body of the character just assigned, that is, having life. The soul is the first grade of actuality of a natural body having life potentially in it. The body so described is a body which is organized. To ask whether soul and body are one is as meaningless as to ask whether the wax and the shape given it by the stamp are one. Self-nutrition is the only psychic power possessed by plants. The soul is the final cause of the body. In this book, he distinguishes between soul and mind, making mind higher than soul and less bound to the body. After speaking of the relation of soul and body, he says, "The case of mind is different. It seems to be an independent substance implanted within the soul and to be incapable of being destroyed." Again, we have no evidence as yet about mind or the power to think. It seems to be a widely different kind of soul, differing as what is eternal from what is perishable. It alone is capable of existence in isolation from all other psychic powers. All the other parts of soul, it is evident from what we have said, are, in spite of certain statements to the contrary, incapable of separate existence. The mind is the part of us that understands mathematics and philosophy. Its objects are timeless, and therefore it is regarded as itself timeless. The soul is what moves the body and perceives sensible objects. It is characterized by self-nutrition, sensation, thinking, and motivity. But the mind has the higher function of thinking, which has no relation to the body or to the senses. Hence, the mind can be immortal, though the rest of the soul cannot. To understand Aristotle's doctrine of the soul, we must remember that the soul is the form of the body, and that spatial shape is one kind of form. What is there in common between soul and shape? I think what is in common is the conferring of unity upon a certain amount of matter. The part of a block of marble which afterwards becomes a statue is, as yet, not separated from the rest of the marble. It is not yet a thing, and has not yet any unity. After the sculptor has made the statue, it has unity, which it derives from its shape. Now, the essential feature of the soul, in virtue of which it is the form of the body, is that it makes the body an organic whole, having purposes as a unit. A single organ has purposes lying outside itself. The eye in isolation cannot see. Thus, many things can be said in which an animal or plant, as a whole, is the subject, which cannot be said about any part of it. It is in this sense that organization or form confers substantiality. That which confers substantiality upon a plant or animal is what Aristotle calls its soul. But mind is something different, less intimately bound up with the body. Perhaps it is a part of the soul, but it is possessed by only a small minority of living beings. Mind as speculation cannot be the cause of movement, for it never thinks about what is practicable and never says what is to be avoided or what pursued. A similar doctrine, though with a slight change of terminology, is set forth in the Nicomachean Ethics. There is in the soul one element that is rational and one that is irrational. The irrational part is twofold: the vegetative, which is found in everything living, even in plants, and the appetitive, which exists in all animals. The life of the rational soul consists in contemplation, which is the complete happiness of man, though not fully attainable. Such a life would be too high for man, for it is not in so far as he is man that he will live so, but in so far as something divine is present in him, and by so much as this is superior to our composite nature, is its activity superior to that which is the exercise of the other kind of virtue, the practical kind. If reason is divine, then in comparison with man, the life in accordance with it is divine in comparison with human life. But we must not follow those who advise us, being men, to think of human things, and being mortal, of mortal things, but must, so far as we can, make ourselves immortal, and strain every nerve to live in accordance with the best things in us. For even if it be small in bulk, much more does it in power and worth surpass everything. It seems from these passages that individuality, what distinguishes one man from another, is connected with the body and the irrational soul, while the rational soul or mind is divine and impersonal. One man likes oysters and another likes pineapples. This distinguishes between them. But when they think about the multiplication table, provided they think correctly, there is no difference between them. The irrational separates us, the rational unites us. Thus, the immortality of mind or reason is not a personal immortality of separate men, but a share in God's immortality. It does not appear that Aristotle believed in personal immortality in the sense in which it was taught by Plato and afterwards by Christianity. He believed only that in so far as men are rational, they partake of the divine, which is immortal. It is open to man to increase the element of the divine in his nature, and to do so is the highest virtue. But if he succeeded completely, he would have ceased to exist as a separate person. This is perhaps not the only possible interpretation of Aristotle's words, but I think it is the most natural. Chapter 20. Aristotle's Ethics. In the corpus of Aristotle's works, three treatises on ethics have a place, but two of these are now generally held to be by disciples. The third, the Nicomachean ethics, remains for the most part unquestioned as to authenticity. But even in this book there is a portion, books 5, 6, and 7, which is held by many to have been incorporated from one of the works of disciples. I shall, however, ignore this controversial question and treat the book as a whole and as Aristotle's. The views of Aristotle on ethics represent, in the main, the prevailing opinions of educated and experienced men of his day. They are not, like Plato's, impregnated with mystical religion, nor do they countenance such unorthodox theories as are to be found in the Republic concerning property and the family. Those who neither fall below nor rise above the level of decent, well-behaved citizens will find in the ethics a systematic account of the principles by which they hold that their conduct should be regulated. Those who demand anything more will be disappointed. The book appeals to the respectable middle-aged, and has been used by them, especially since the 17th century, to repress the ardors and enthusiasms of the young. But to a man with any depth of feeling, it cannot but be repulsive. The good, we are told, is happiness, which is an activity of the soul. Aristotle says that Plato was right in dividing the soul into two parts, one rational, the other irrational. The irrational part itself he divides into the vegetative, which is found even in plants, and the appetitive, which is found in all animals. The appetitive part may be in some degree rational, when the goods that it seeks are such as reason approves of. This is essential to the account of virtue, for reason alone, in Aristotle, is purely contemplative, and does not, without the help of appetite, lead to any practical activity. There are two kinds of virtues, intellectual and moral, corresponding to the two parts of the soul. Intellectual virtues result from teaching, moral virtues from habit. It is the business of the legislator to make the citizens good by forming good habits. We become just by performing just acts, and similarly as regards other virtues. By being compelled to acquire good habits, we shall in time, Aristotle thinks, come to find pleasure in performing good actions. One is reminded of Hamlet's speech to his mother. Assume a virtue if you have it not. That monster custom, who all sense doth eat, of habit's devil, is angel yet in this, that to the use of actions fair and good, he likewise gives a frock or livery that aptly is put on. We now come to the famous doctrine of the golden mean. Every virtue is a mean between two extremes, each of which is a vice. This is proved by an examination of the various virtues. Courage is a mean between cowardice and rashness. Liberality between prodigality and meanness. Proper pride between vanity and humility. Ready wit between buffoonery and boorishness. Modesty between bashfulness and shamelessness. Some virtues do not seem to fit into this scheme. For instance, truthfulness. Aristotle says that this is a mean between boastfulness and mock modesty. But this only applies to truthfulness about oneself. I do not see how truthfulness in any wider sense can be fitted into the scheme. There was once a mayor who had adopted Aristotle's doctrine. At the end of his term of office, he made a speech saying that he had endeavored to steer the narrow line between partiality on the one hand and impartiality on the other. The view of truthfulness as a mean seems scarcely less absurd. Aristotle's opinions on moral questions are always such as were conventional in his day. On some points they differ from those of our time, chiefly where some form of aristocracy comes in. We think that human beings, at least in ethical theory, all have equal rights and that justice involves equality. Aristotle thinks that justice involves not equality, but right proportion, which is only sometimes equality. The justice of a master or a father is a different thing from that of a citizen, for a son or slave is property, and there can be no injustice to one's own property. As regards slaves, however, there is a slight modification of this doctrine in connection with the question whether it is possible for a man to be a friend of his slave. There is nothing in common between the two parties. The slave is a living tool. Qua slave, then one cannot be friends with him. But qua man, one can, for there seems to be some justice between any man and any other who can share in a system of law or be a party to an agreement. Therefore, there can also be friendship with him in so far as he is a man. A father can repudiate his son if he is wicked, but a son cannot repudiate his father because he owes him more than he can possibly repay, especially existence. In unequal relations, it is right, since everybody should be loved in proportion to his worth, that the inferior should love the superior more than the superior loves the inferior. Wives, children, subjects should have more love for husbands, parents, and monarchs than the latter have for them. In a good marriage, the man rules in accordance with his worth, and in those matters in which a man should rule, but the matters that befit a woman he hands over to her. He should not rule in her province, still less should she rule in his, as sometimes happens when she is an heiress. The best individual, as conceived by Aristotle, is a very different person from the Christian saint. He should have proper pride, and not underestimate his own merits. He should despise whoever deserves to be despised. The description of the proud or magnanimous man is very interesting as showing the difference between pagan and Christian ethics and the sense in which Nietzsche was justified in regarding Christianity as a slave morality. Footnote. The Greek word means literally great-souled and is usually translated magnanimous, but the Oxford translation renders it proud. Neither word, in its modern usage, quite expresses Aristotle's meaning, but I prefer magnanimous, and have therefore substituted it for proud in the above quotation from the Oxford translation. End of footnote. The magnanimous man, since he deserves most, must be good in the highest degree. For the better man always deserves more, and the best man most. Therefore the truly magnanimous man must be good. And greatness and every virtue would seem to be characteristic of the magnanimous man. And it would be most unbecoming for the magnanimous man to fly from danger, swinging his arms by his sides, or to wrong another. For to what end should he do disgraceful acts, he to whom nothing is great? Magnanimity, then, seems to be a sort of crown of the virtues, for it makes them greater, and it is not found without them. Therefore, it is hard to be truly magnanimous, for it is impossible without nobility and goodness of character. It is chiefly with honours and dishonours, then, that the magnanimous man is concerned, and at honours that are great and conferred by good men he will be moderately pleased, thinking that he is coming by his own, or even less than his own. For there can be no honour that is worthy of perfect virtue. Yet he will at any rate accept it, since they have nothing greater to bestow on him. But honour from casual people, and on trifling grounds, he will utterly despise, since it is not this that he deserves, and dishonour too, since in his case it cannot be just. Power and wealth are desirable for the sake of honour, and to him for whom even honour is a little thing, the others must be so too. Hence, magnanimous men are thought to be disdainful. The magnanimous man does not run into trifling dangers, but he will face great dangers. And when he is in danger, he is unsparing of his life, knowing that there are conditions on which life is not worth having. And he is the sort of man to confer benefits, but he is ashamed of receiving them. For the one is the mark of a superior, the other of an inferior. And he is apt to confer greater benefits in return, for thus the original benefactor, besides being repaid, will incur a debt to him. It is the mark of the magnanimous man to ask for nothing, or scarcely anything, but to give help readily, and to be dignified towards people who enjoy a high position, but unassuming towards those of the middle class. For it is a difficult and lofty thing to be superior to the former, but easy to be so to the latter. And a lofty bearing over the former is no mark of ill-breeding, but among humble people it is as vulgar as a display of strength against the weak. He must also be open in his hate and in his love, for to conceal one's feelings, that is, to care less for truth than for what people think, is a coward's part. He is free of speech because he is contemptuous, and he is given to telling the truth, except when he speaks in irony to the vulgar. Nor is he given to admiration, for him nothing is great. Nor is he a gossip, for he will speak neither about himself nor about another, since he cares not to be praised, nor for others to be blamed. He is one who will possess beautiful and profitless things, rather than profitable and useful ones. Further, a slow step is thought proper to the magnanimous man, a deep voice and a level utterance. Such, then, is the magnanimous man. The man who falls short of him is unduly humble, and the man who goes beyond him is vain. One shudders to think what a vain man would be like. Whatever may be thought of the magnanimous man, one thing is clear. There cannot be very many of him in a community. I do not mean merely in the general sense, in which there are not likely to be many virtuous men on the ground that virtue is difficult. What I mean is that the virtues of the magnanimous man largely depend upon his having an exceptional social position. Aristotle considers ethics a branch of politics, and it is not surprising, after his praise of pride, to find that he considers monarchy the best form of government, and aristocracy the next best. Monarchs and aristocrats can be magnanimous, but ordinary citizens would be laughable if they attempted to live up to such a pattern. This brings up a question which is half ethical, half political. Can we regard as morally satisfactory a community which, by its essential constitution, confines the best things to a few and requires the majority to be content with the second best? Plato and Aristotle say yes, and Nietzsche agrees with them. Stoics, Christians, and Democrats say no, but there are great differences in their ways of saying no. Stoics and early Christians consider that the greatest good is virtue, and that external circumstances cannot prevent a man from being virtuous. There is therefore no need to seek a just social system, since social injustice affects only unimportant matters. The Democrat, on the contrary, usually holds that, at least so far as politics are concerned, the most important goods are power and property. He cannot, therefore, acquiesce in a social system which is unjust in these respects. The Stoic Christian view requires a conception of virtue very different from Aristotle's, since it must hold that virtue is as possible for the slave as for his master. Christian ethics disapproves of pride, which Aristotle thinks a virtue, and praises humility, which he thinks a vice. The intellectual virtues, which Plato and Aristotle value above all others, have to be thrust out of the list altogether, in order that the poor and humble may be able to be as virtuous as anyone else. Pope Gregory the Great solemnly reproved a bishop for teaching grammar. The Aristotelian view that the highest virtue is for the few is logically connected with the subordination of ethics to politics. If the aim is the good community rather than the good individual, it is possible that the good community may be one in which there is subordination. In an orchestra, the first violin is more important than the oboe, though both are necessary for the excellence of the whole. It is impossible to organize an orchestra on the principle of giving to each man what would be best for him as an isolated individual. The same sort of thing applies to the government of a large modern state, however democratic. A modern democracy, unlike those of antiquity, confers great power upon certain chosen individuals, presidents or prime ministers, and must expect of them kinds of merit which are not expected of the ordinary citizen. When people are not thinking in terms of religion or political controversy, they are likely to hold that a good president is more to be honored than a good bricklayer. In a democracy, a president is not expected to be quite like Aristotle's magnanimous man. But still he is expected to be rather different from the average citizen and to have certain merits connected with his station. These peculiar merits would perhaps not be considered ethical, but that is because we use this adjective in a narrower sense than that in which it was used by Aristotle. As a result of Christian dogma, the distinction between moral and other merits has become much sharper than it was in Greek times. It is a merit in a man to be a great poet or composer or painter, but not a moral merit. We do not consider him the more virtuous for possessing such aptitudes or the more likely to go to heaven. Moral merit is concerned solely with acts of will, that is, with choosing rightly among possible causes of action. Footnote. It is true that Aristotle also says this, but as he means it, the consequences are not so far-reaching as in the Christian interpretation. End of footnote. I am not to blame for not composing an opera because I don't know how to do it. The orthodox view is that Wherever two courses of action are possible, conscience tells me which is right, and to choose the other is sin. Virtue consists mainly in the avoidance of sin rather than in anything positive. There is no reason to expect an educated man to be morally better than an uneducated man, or a clever man than a stupid man. In this way, a number of merits of great social importance are shut out from the realm of ethics. The adjective unethical in modern usage has a much narrower range than the adjective undesirable. It is undesirable to be feeble-minded, but not unethical. Many modern philosophers, however, have not accepted this view of ethics. They have thought that one should first define the good and then say that our actions ought to be such as tend to realize the good. This point of view is more like that of Aristotle, who holds that happiness is the good. The highest happiness, it is true, is only open to the philosopher, but to him that is no objection to the theory. Ethical theories may be divided into two classes, according as they regard virtue as an end or a means. Aristotle, on the whole, takes the view that virtues are means to an end, namely happiness. The end, then, being what we wish for, the means what we deliberate about and choose, actions concerning means must be according to choice and voluntary. Now, the exercise of the virtues is concerned with means. But there is another sense of virtue in which it is included in the ends of action. Human good is activity of soul in accordance with virtue in a complete life. I think he would say that the intellectual virtues are ends, but the practical virtues are only means. Christian moralists hold that while the consequences of virtuous actions are in general good, they are not as good as the virtuous actions themselves, which are to be valued on their own account, and not on account of their effects. On the other hand, those who consider pleasure the good regard virtues solely as means. Any other definition of the good, except the definition as virtue, will have the same consequence. The virtues are meant to goods other than themselves. On this question, Aristotle, as already said, agrees mainly, though not wholly, with those who think the first business of ethics is to define the good, and that virtue is to be defined as action tending to produce the good. The relation of ethics to politics raises another ethical question of considerable importance. Granted that the good at which right action should aim is the good of the whole community, or ultimately of the whole human race, is this social good a sum of goods enjoyed by individuals, or is it something belonging essentially to the whole, not to the parts? Pleasures are largely associated with different parts of the body, but we consider them as belonging to a person as a whole. We may enjoy a pleasant smell, but we know that the nose alone could not enjoy it. Some contend that, in a closely organized community, there are, analogously, excellences belonging to the whole, but not to any part. If they are metaphysicians, they may hold, like Hegel, that whatever quality is good is an attribute of the universe as a whole. But they will generally add that it is less mistaken to attribute good to a state than to an individual. Logically, the view may be put as follows. We can attribute to a state various predicates that cannot be attributed to its separate members. That it is populous, extensive, powerful, etc. The view we are considering puts ethical predicates in this class and says that they only derivatively belong to individuals. A man may belong to a populous state or to a good state, but he, they say, is no more good than he is populous. This view, which has been widely held by German philosophers, is not Aristotle's, except possibly in some degree in his conception of justice. A considerable part of the ethics is occupied with the discussion of friendship, including all relations that involve affection. Perfect friendship is only possible between the good, and it is impossible to be friends with many people. One should not be friends with a person of higher station than one's own, unless he is also of higher virtue, which will justify the respect shown to him. We have seen that, in unequal relations, such as those of man and wife, or father and son, the superior should be the more loved. It is impossible to be friends with God, because he cannot love us. Aristotle discusses whether a man can be a friend to himself, and decides that this is only possible if he is a good man. Wicked men, he asserts, often hate themselves. The good man should love himself, but nobly. Friends are a comfort in misfortune, but one should not make them unhappy by seeking their sympathy, as is done by women and womanish men. It is not only in misfortune that friends are desirable, for the happy man needs friends with whom to share his happiness. No one would choose the whole world on condition of being alone, since man is a political creature and one whose nature is to live with others. All that is said about friendship is sensible, but there is not a word that rises above common sense. Aristotle again shows his good sense in the discussion of pleasure, which Plato had regarded somewhat ascetically. Pleasure, as Aristotle uses the word, is distinct from happiness, that there can be no happiness without pleasure. There are, he says, three views of pleasure. One, that it is never good. Two, that some pleasure is good, but most is bad. Three, that pleasure is good, but not the best. He rejects the first of these on the ground that pain is certainly bad, and therefore pleasure must be good. He says, very justly, that it is nonsense to say a man can be happy on the rack. Some degree of external good fortune is necessary for happiness. He also disposes of the view that all pleasures are bodily. All things have something divine, and therefore some capacity for higher pleasures. Good men have pleasure unless they are unfortunate, and God always enjoys a single and simple pleasure. There is another discussion of pleasure in a later part of the book, which is not wholly consistent with the above. Here it is argued that there are bad pleasures, which, however, are not pleasures to good people, that perhaps pleasures differ in kind, and that pleasures are good or bad according as they are connected with good or bad activities. There are things that are valued more than pleasure. No one would be content to go through life with a child's intellect, even if it were pleasant to do so. Each animal has its proper pleasure, and the proper pleasure of man is connected with reason. This leads on to the only doctrine in the book which is not mere common sense. Happiness lies in virtuous activity, and perfect happiness lies in the best activity, which is contemplative. Contemplation is preferable to war or politics or any other practical career, because it allows leisure, and leisure is essential to happiness. Practical virtue brings only a secondary kind of happiness. The supreme happiness is in the exercise of reason, for reason, more than anything else, is man. Man cannot be wholly contemplative, but in so far as he is so, he shares in the divine life. The activity of God, which surpasses all others in blessedness, must be contemplative. Of all human beings, the philosopher is the most godlike in his activity, and therefore the happiest and best. He who exercises his reason and cultivates it seems to be both in the best state of mind and most dear to the gods. For if the gods have any care for human affairs, as they are thought to have, it would be reasonable both that they should delight in that which was best and most akin to them, that is, reason, and that they should reward those who love and honour this most, as caring for the things that are dear to them and acting both rightly and nobly. And that all these attributes belong most of all to the philosopher is manifest. He, therefore, is the dearest to the gods. And he who is that will presumably be also the happiest. So that in this way, too, the philosopher will more than any other be happy. This passage is virtually the peroration of the Ethics. The few paragraphs that follow are concerned with the transition to politics.
After 30 seconds,
try to decide what we are to think of the merits and demerits of the Ethics. Unlike many other subjects treated by Greek philosophers, Ethics has not made any definite advances in the sense of ascertained discoveries. Nothing in Ethics is known in a scientific sense. There is therefore no reason why an ancient treatise on it should be in any respect inferior to a modern one. When Aristotle talks about astronomy, we can say definitely that he is wrong. But when he talks about ethics, we cannot say in the same sense either that he is wrong or that he is right. Broadly speaking, there are three questions that we can ask about the ethics of Aristotle or of any other philosopher. 1. Is it internally self-consistent? 2. Is it consistent with the remainder of the author's views? 3. Does it give answers to ethical problems that are consonant to our own ethical feelings? If the answer to either the first or second question is in the negative, the philosopher in question has been guilty of some intellectual error. But if the answer to the third question is in the negative, we have no right to say that he is mistaken. We have only the right to say that we do not like him. Let us examine these three questions in turn as regards the ethical theory set forth in the Nicomachean Ethics. 1. On the whole, the book is self-consistent, except in a few not very important respects. The doctrine that the good is happiness and that happiness consists in successful activity is well worked out. The doctrine that every virtue is a mean between two extremes, though very ingeniously developed, is less successful, since it does not apply to intellectual contemplation, which we are told is the best of all activities. It can, however, be maintained that the doctrine of the mean is only intended to apply to the practical virtues, not to those of the intellect. Perhaps, to take another point, the position of the legislator is somewhat ambiguous. He is to cause children and young people to acquire the habit of performing good actions, which will, in the end, lead them to find pleasure in virtue, and to act virtuously without the need of legal compulsion. It is obvious that the legislator might equally well cause the young to acquire bad habits. If this is to be avoided, he must have all the wisdom of a Platonic guardian. And if it is not avoided, the argument that a virtuous life is pleasant will fail. This problem, however, belongs perhaps more to politics than to ethics. 2. Aristotle's ethics is, at all points, consistent with his metaphysics. Indeed, his metaphysical theories are themselves the expression of an ethical optimism. He believes in the scientific importance of final causes, and this implies the belief that purpose governs the course of development in the universe. He thinks that changes are, in the main, such as embody an increase of organization or form, and at bottom, virtuous actions are those that favor this tendency. It is true that a great deal of his practical ethics is not particularly philosophical, but merely the result of observation of human affairs. But this part of his doctrine, though it may be independent of his metaphysics, is not inconsistent with it. 3. When we come to compare Aristotle's ethical tastes with our own, we find, in the first place, as already noted, an acceptance of inequality which is repugnant to much modern sentiment. Not only is there no objection to slavery, or to the superiority of husbands and fathers over wives and children, but it is held that what is best is essentially only for the few, proud men and philosophers. Most men, it would seem to follow, are mainly means for the production of a few rulers and sages. Kant maintains that every human being is an end in himself, and this may be taken as an expression of the view introduced by Christianity. There is, however, a logical difficulty in Kant's view, since it gives no means of reaching a decision when two men's interests clash. If each is an end in himself, how are we to arrive at a principle for determining which shall give way? Such a principle must have to do with the community rather than with the individual. In the broadest sense of the word, it will have to be a principle of justice. Bentham and the utilitarians interpret justice as equality. When two men's interests clash, the right course is that which produces the greatest total of happiness, regardless of which of the two enjoys it, or how it is shared among them. If more is given to the better man than to the worse, that is because, in the long run, the general happiness is increased by rewarding virtue and punishing vice, not because of an ultimate ethical doctrine that the good deserve more than the bad. Justice, in this view, consists in considering only the amount of happiness involved, without favor to one individual or class as against another. Greek philosophers, including Plato and Aristotle, had a different conception of justice, and it is one which is still widely prevalent. They thought, originally on grounds derived from religion, that each thing or person had its or his proper sphere, to overstep which is unjust. Some men, in virtue of their character and aptitudes, have a wider sphere than others, and there is no injustice if they enjoy a greater share of happiness. This view is taken for granted in Aristotle, but its basis in primitive religion, which is evidence in the earliest philosophers, is no longer apparent in his writings. There is in Aristotle an almost complete absence of what may be called benevolence or philanthropy. The sufferings of mankind, in so far as he is aware of them, do not move him emotionally. He holds them intellectually to be an evil, but there is no evidence that they cause him unhappiness, except when the sufferers happen to be his friends. More generally, there is an emotional poverty in the ethics which is not found in the earlier philosophers. There is something unduly smug and comfortable about Aristotle's speculations on human affairs. Everything that makes men feel a passionate interest in each other seems to be forgotten. Even his account of friendship is tepid. He shows no sign of having had any of those experiences which make it difficult to preserve sanity. All the more profound aspects of the moral life are apparently unknown to him. He leaves out, one may say, the whole sphere of human experience with which religion is concerned. What he has to say is what will be useful to comfortable men of weak passions, but he has nothing to say to those who are possessed by a god or a devil, or whom outward misfortune drives to despair. For these reasons, in my judgment, his ethics, in spite of its fame, is lacking in intrinsic importance. Chapter 21. Aristotle's Politics. Aristotle's Politics is both interesting and important. Interesting as showing the common prejudices of educated Greeks in his time, and important as a source of many principles which remained influential until the end of the Middle Ages. I do not think there is much in it that could be of any practical use to a statesman of the present day, but there is a great deal that throws light on the conflicts of parties in different parts of the Hellenic world. There is not very much awareness of methods of government in non-Hellenic states. There are, it is true, allusions to Egypt, Babylon, Persia, and Carthage, but except in the case of Carthage, they are somewhat perfunctory. There is no mention of Alexander, and not even the faintest awareness of the complete transformation that he was effecting in the world. The whole discussion is concerned with city-states, and there is no prevision of their obsolescence. Greece, owing to its division into independent cities, was a laboratory of political experiment. But nothing to which these experiments were relevant existed from Aristotle's time until the rise of the Italian cities in the Middle Ages. In many ways, the experience to which Aristotle appeals is more relevant to the comparatively modern world than to any that existed for 1500 years after the book was written. There are many pleasant incidental remarks, some of which may be noted before we embark upon political theory. We are told that Euripides, when he was staying at the court of Archelaus, king of Macedon, was accused of halitosis by a certain Decamnicus. To soothe his fury, the king gave him permission to scourge Decamnicus, which he did. Decamnicus, after waiting many years, joined in a successful plot to kill the king, but by this time Euripides was dead. We are told that children should be conceived in winter, when the wind is in the north, that there must be a careful avoidance of indecency because shameful words lead to shameful acts, and that obscenity is never to be tolerated except in temples, where the law permits even ribaldry. People should not marry too young, because if they do, the children will be weak and female, the wives will become wanton, and the husbands stunted in their growth. The right age for marriage is 37 in men, 18 in women. We learn how Thales, being taunted with his poverty, bought up all the olive presses on the installment plan and was then able to charge monopoly rates for their use. This he did to show that philosophers can make money, and if they remain poor, it is because they have something more important than wealth to think about. All this, however, is by the way. It is time to come to more serious matters. The book begins by pointing out the importance of the state. It is the highest kind of community and aims at the highest good. In order of time, the family comes first. It is built on the two fundamental relations of man and woman, master and slave, both of which are natural. Several families combined make a village. Several villages, a state, provided the combination is nearly large enough to be self-sufficing. The state, though later in time than the family, is prior to it, and even to the individual by nature. For what each thing is when fully developed, we call its nature. And human society, fully developed, is a state, and the whole is prior to the part. The conception involved here is that of organism. A hand, when the body is destroyed, is, we are told, no longer a hand. The implication is that a hand is to be defined by its purpose, that of grasping, which it can only perform when joined to a living body. In like manner, an individual cannot fulfill his purpose unless he is part of a state. He who founded the state, Aristotle says, was the greatest of benefactors. For without law, man is the worst of animals, and law depends for its existence on the state. The state is not a mere society for exchange and the prevention of crime. The end of the state is the good life, and the state is the union of families and villages in a perfect and self-sufficing life, by which we mean a happy and honorable life. A political society exists for the sake of noble actions, not of mere companionship. A state, being composed of households, each of which consists of one family, the discussion of politics should begin with the family. The bulk of this discussion is concerned with slavery, for in antiquity the slaves were always reckoned as part of the family. Slavery is expedient and right, but the slave should be naturally inferior to the master. From birth, some are marked out for subjection, others for rule. The man who is by nature not his own, but another man's, is by nature a slave. Slaves should not be Greeks, but of an inferior race with less spirit. Tame animals are better off when ruled by man, and so are those who are naturally inferior when ruled by their superiors. It may be questioned whether the practice of making slaves out of prisoners of war is justified. Power, such as leads to victory in war, seems to imply superior virtue, but this is not always the case. War, however, is just when waged against men who, though intended by nature to be governed, will not submit. And in this case, it is implied, it would be right to make slaves of the conquered. This would seem enough to justify any conqueror who ever lived, for no nation will admit that it is intended by nature to be governed, and the only evidence as to nature's intentions must be derived from the outcome of war. In every war, therefore, the victors are in the right and the vanquished in the wrong. Very satisfactory. Next comes a discussion of trade, which profoundly influenced scholastic casuistry. There are two uses of a thing, one proper, the other improper. A shoe, for instance, may be worn, which is its proper use, or exchanged, which is its improper use. It follows that there is something degraded about a shoemaker who must exchange his shoes in order to live. Retail trade, we are told, is not a natural part of the art of getting wealth. The natural way to get wealth is by skillful management of house and land. To the wealth that can be made in this way, there is a limit, but to what can be made by trade, there is none. Trade has to do with money, but wealth is not the acquisition of coin. Wealth derived from trade is justly hated because it is unnatural. The most hated sort, and with the greatest reason, is usury, which makes a gain out of money itself and not from the natural object of it. For money was intended to be used in exchange, but not to increase at interest. Of all modes of getting wealth, this is the most unnatural. What came of this dictum, you may read in Tawney's Religion and the Rise of Capitalism. But while his history is reliable, his comment has a bias in favor of what is pre-capitalistic. Usury means all lending money at interest, not only as now lending at an exorbitant rate. From Greek times to the present day, mankind, or at least the economically more developed portion of them, have been divided into debtors and creditors. Debtors have disapproved of interest, and creditors have approved of it. At most times, landowners have been debtors, while men engaged in commerce have been creditors. The views of philosophers, with few exceptions, have coincided with the pecuniary interests of their class. Greek philosophers belonged to, or were employed by, the landowning class. They therefore disapproved of interest. Medieval philosophers were churchmen, and the property of the church was mainly in land. They therefore saw no reason to revise Aristotle's opinion. Their objection to usury was reinforced by anti-Semitism, for most fluid capital was Jewish. Ecclesiastics and barons had their quarrels, sometimes very bitter, but they could combine against the wicked Jew who had tided them over a bad harvest by means of a loan and considered that he deserved some reward for his thrift. With the Reformation, the situation changed. Many of the most earnest Protestants were businessmen, to whom lending money at interest was essential. Consequently, first Calvin and then other Protestant divines sanctioned interest. At last, the Catholic Church was compelled to follow suit, because the old prohibition did not suit the modern world. Philosophers whose incomes are derived from the investments of universities have favored interest ever since they ceased to be ecclesiastics, and therefore connected with landowning. At every stage, there has been a wealth of theoretical argument to support the economically convenient opinion. Plato's Utopia is criticized by Aristotle on various grounds. There is first the very interesting comment that it gives too much unity to the state, and would make it into an individual. Next comes the kind of argument against the proposed abolition of the family that naturally occurs to every reader. Plato thinks that by merely giving the title of son to all who are of an age that makes their sonship possible, a man will acquire towards the whole multitude the sentiments that men have at present towards their actual sons, and correlatively as regard the title father. Aristotle, on the contrary, says that what is common to the greatest number receives the least care, and that if sons are common to many fathers, they will be neglected in common. It is better to be a cousin in reality than a son in Plato's sense. Plato's plan would make love watery. Then there is a curious argument that, since abstinence from adultery is a virtue, it would be a pity to have a social system which abolishes this virtue and the correlative vice. Then we are asked, if women are common, who will manage the house? I wrote an essay once called Architecture and the Social System, in which I pointed out that all who combine communism with abolition of the family also advocate communal houses for large numbers, with communal kitchens, dining rooms, and nurseries. This system may be described as monasteries without celibacy. It is essential to the carrying out of Plato's plans, but it is certainly not more impossible than many other things that he recommends. Plato's communism annoys Aristotle. It would lead, he says, to anger against lazy people and to the sort of quarrels that are common between fellow travellers. It is better if each minds his own business. Property should be private, but people should be so trained in benevolence as to allow the use of it to be largely common.